Listening to Shahib Sihab with Seeds. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is indeed our Wednesday. It is April the 9th, and a program that I hope you would find useful and informative. Why? Because we want to smash the political duopoly. And we are going to do that today, give you the ammunition so that you could get out of the choice that we end up having to make all the time. We end up having to choose, as the saying goes, not only between the the lesser of two evils, but the evil of two lessers. You know, it's an interesting thing that in the United States you can handle, or you can be trusted to handle, the purchase of a car. Because there are so many models to choose from, hundreds of them. But you could handle that. You could buy a suit very easily. You could handle that, although there are thousands and thousands to choose from. But you want to cast a smart vote? Well, now you're in trouble, because you are pretty much limited in that regard. You would have a choice of party A and party B, and in some places they are completely indistinguishable from each other. And once you pull that lever, you are supposed to leave and go to your home or go to your job, if you're still lucky to have one, and you will have participated in the democratic process. Well, our guest, Professor J. David Gillespie, he is the author of Challengers to Duopoly, Why Third Parties Matter in American Two-Party Politics, and he's going to be talking about the value of multiplicity of parties and why it is we don't seem to have that. Thank you, Professor Gillespie, for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Eutrice. This is going to be great.
Well, let me let people know what you are all about. You're a professor of political science at the College of Charleston and the Citadel. You have written extensively on third parties and provided testimony in federal and state ballot access cases. You occasionally teach a course on American political parties and on third party politics, and you have written several articles and two books on the subject, including the one which will serve as the basis for our discussion today, Challengers to Duopoly, Why Third Parties Matter in American Two-Party Politics, and Politics at the Periphery, Third Parties in Two-Party America. Now, if third parties are such a good thing, if third parties are so key to the democratic process, how come we don't have it?
Well, there you get into the barriers that duopoly poses. And anybody who wants to bring those barriers down, as I really do, and as you indicated that you do in the lead-in, had better be aware that it's a tough proposition to bring them down. They are just absolutely amazing. You know, back in the beginning of the 20th century, we had a pretty naturally evolving two-party system. And there were a lot of things that indicated that maybe the things that caused a two-party system in this country were sort of a natural duopoly or natural dualism, I should say. Since that time, we have done our very best to undergird that, to protect the Democrats and the Republicans by undergirding through legislation, through judicial acts and all of that, a duopoly. And a duopoly is really different from a naturally evolved two-party system, because a duopoly is a party regime. I just got back from China, and I saw in China a one-party regime. What we have in this country is really a two-party regime. And so we can talk about those barriers, but going into it, it's going to be a tough job to bring those down.
When did the third-party system see its glory? When were the glory days of multiplicity of parties?
Most people would say the 19th century was the golden age for third parties. There were periods during which we went through transitions. There actually was one third party that came in out of the coal and has become something of a model for others that want to do the same thing. That's the Republican Party, managed to institutionalize itself, having started as a third party. But the 19th century was the golden flowering era, most people would say, for third parties.
There's been an interesting psychological, aside to this whole thing, and that is, it seems as if just the idea of discussing third parties is kind of undemocratic. You have a perfect system, why would you want more? And therefore, if you are into third-party politics or multiple-party politics, you are automatically castigated as being something other than true blue American. What is the fear of third parties?
Well, every once in a while, we undergird that fear. There have been two periods in the 20th century in which the regime or the system went after, especially third parties of the left. You know, after World War One, there was the Red Scare, and then there was the McCarthy period after World War Two, and then after that, there was a period in which an FBI organization called COINTELPRO went after especially third parties of the left. So that undergirds this idea that third parties are somehow un-American. And I think it has not only affected third parties of the left, it's affected third parties in general, this general perception that two is enough, and that if you want more than two, you're somehow a kind of a weird figure out there. And yet, Utrecht, we have gone beyond that. That's what I've learned when I was a kid. You know, mom's apple pie and the two-party system. And that's not what surveys show these days. Surveys show that most Americans say that they favor more than two major parties. Now, that's a pretty general kind of thing, but that is the beginning of something. We have record numbers of people who declare themselves now, even when they register to vote, to be independents rather than Democrats or Republicans, and many of them where they have the opportunity, and that's fairly rare, even declare themselves to be members of some third political party. And yet we're in this habit of voting for the lesser of two evils. And it is because, you know, political scientists call this voting strategically. Americans now talk regularly about voting for the lesser of two evils. The idea is the only two parties that can win are either the Democrats or the Republicans. And if you favor another political party than one of those, you've got to vote with your head rather than your heart, and you've got to go for the one closer to your sentiments that has a chance of winning. And so we've got a long way to go to get beyond that, but that's where we are right now.
How do the two main parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, how do they basically conspire, for lack of a better term, to lock out any potential threat from a burgeoning multi-party or third party.
Okay, let's talk about that. There are certain things that we inherit today from the constitutional framers that are beneficial to just two parties. One of those is the Electoral College. Ross Perot got 20% of the popular votes, not one single electoral vote. The other is the single-member district system of election rather than what most democracies now have, which is proportional representation, where you divvy out seats in a multi-candidate kind of situation based upon how the parties line up and what percentages they get. We always, almost always have one winner, one major party loser, and anybody who dares to go beyond that second possibility is regarded as throwing his vote away. And so those things we pretty much inherit. There's a disinclination to tamper with those because they do serve the Democrats and Republicans. But grafted on top of that, there are a whole bunch of other things, the most notorious of which the whole system of ballot access requirements. It's estimated now that for a new political party running for the presidency to get on the ballot of all 51 jurisdictions that have electoral votes to cast, you would have to have probably something like 250,000 valid signatures, probably double that because a lot of those signatures you collect will be deemed invalid. It's going up now rather than going back. For a while, it was becoming a little bit easier to break through ballot access requirements, but now it's going back up. And on top of that, we have a situation now where states are requiring earlier and earlier deadlines for filing those, all the way back into August or even July before the November election. So we've got that problem. If you are starting out, you better have two or three ballot access lawyers working for you. The last couple of candidates that made all 51 jurisdictions spent almost all of their money just making the 51 ballots. And we haven't had a single presidential candidate without a D or an R by his name that has been on all 51 since 1996. And you can say the same thing about third parties working below the presidential level. We've got the debate discrimination. The prefix for the Commission on Presidential Debates that now governs who gets on the fall debate stage is the Bipartisan Commission on Presidential Debates. It used to be the League of Women Voters did that, and they did a pretty good job of opening things up. But now you have to have 15% in the five most recent public opinion polls. And that's very hard, almost impossible for a new political party to do. That's what it takes to get on the debate stage. And so we haven't had a non-D, non-R presidential candidate on a general election debate stage since 1992. And Ross Perot.
That was Ross Perot.
That was Ross Perot. And quirky though he was, that said to the American people, this guy is serious and he is to be taken seriously. And that's precisely why the duopoly wants to keep third-party candidates off that debate stage. There's sore loser laws. Many states have passed rules that say that if you ran earlier on for the nomination of a party, you can't later run on another party label in the general election. That is to discourage people from picking up and running as third-party candidates. So what you do is to try to co-opt them through your primary system, and then once they lose in that, then they're disqualified in the general election. Most states have anti-fusion laws. New York, the state where you are, is the leader in fusion between major and minor parties, but only about 8 states have fusion. And fusion can be, it's a double-edged sword, but it can be very good for third parties. People in New York know that the Independence Party and the Working Families Party and the Conservative Party have some clout because they can reward and punish the major parties for, you know, their positions on policy and patronage and all kinds of things. So all of those things are part of the process of foreclosing on any kind of real challengers. And it's really amazing to me because you hear so many people talking about how the Democrats and the Republicans don't like each other anymore. And, you know, it used to be Tweedledum, Tweedledee, there's not a dime's worth of difference. Maybe there's a quarter's worth of difference now. But on one thing they agree, and that is 2 is enough, and 3 is too many.
Why hasn't this system, because it is a system, and it seems to be conspiratorial in nature, and certainly it seems to be anti-democratic in nature, which means that it should occur to people that a system that does these things, locks people out, makes it impossible for them to qualify on the basis of valid signatures and the ever-increasing numbers of signatures you have to have in order to be on the ballot, all these things that are designed to prohibit democracy. Why hasn't this caused major and consistent debate, open debate and challenge, even in the court of law, about why it is this system is organized literally to lock people out?
Outside of the mainstream, there are numerous challenges, and many of them are court challenges. There is a person who has devoted his entire life to challenging in court these kinds of terribly oligarchical discriminatory things. His name is Richard Winger. He lives in San Francisco, and he is himself a libertarian, but he devotes himself to opening up the process to anybody, independents, third parties of any sort, to challenge the Democrats and the Republicans. He was involved, for example, after the 2012 election in leading a challenge to the state of Michigan that used its sore loser law to disqualify the Libertarian candidate who had run earlier in the Republican primary, and therefore Michigan said, you can't run in the general election. The reason why they usually don't work is that our judicial system is politicized. There's no doubt about that. You can imagine it's not just a matter of opening up the ballot. It's also a matter of other things that the Supreme Court, for example, is doing. This most recent McCutcheon decision, and before that the Citizens United decision, Democrats say they don't like those decisions either. But you can imagine what that does to this kind of corporatization of our electoral process. You can imagine what that does to poor third parties that don't have much money to spend and all of that sort of thing. So I think the politicization of our judicial system is in large measure the reason why the rules don't get changed as they should.
Well, you've written 2 books and several articles. You've taken on this question of third-party politics. As the author of 2 books on this particular subject, what would you say was even alarming to you as you prepared yourself to do the research on this? What did you discover that was particularly alarming to you about the third-party process?
Well, basically, I think, looking at it from the standpoint of what third parties have been able to achieve and contribute in our history, and then counterposing that to the closing of the doors on this and what they attempt to achieve even today, and They're still contributors in the marketplace of ideas. But just how closed that marketplace has come to this participation by third parties. If I might, Utrice, I'd like to tell your listeners something about the there that third parties have gotten to before the major parties have even thought about getting there in terms of public policy in our history. Can I take a little bit of time to do that? Going back to the 19th century, transparency in government was first raised as a beckoning call by a third party. The abolition of slavery, women's suffrage, there were at least six third political parties that not only began to champion women's suffrage, but began to devote their attention to it in a fulsome sort of way before finally in 1916 the Republican and the Democratic parties both put in their platform women's suffrage. Universal health care, that first appeared in the Bull Moose Progressive platform in 1912. The abolition of child labor in the United States, Social Security. You can just go down through the list, and these are things that third parties have contributed. They have always gotten there ahead of the Democrats and the Republicans in terms of opening up the political process to nomination for the highest offices in the land. The first woman to run for president, she ran in 1872 on a third-party ticket called the Equal Rights Ticket. The first African-American to run for the vice presidency ran on the communist ticket in 1932. The first openly gay person to ever run for the presidency to win the nomination was David McReynolds in 1980. And so whatever there is, third parties have gotten there first. And I don't mean to suggest that they've gotten there alone. Oftentimes, interest groups have maybe even been the leaders. Third parties have been a part of the coalition, but they have been leaders in the sense of influencing the major parties to get there. And by the way, third parties oftentimes die, but they oftentimes die a successful death because when their ideas become popular, they are stolen by the major parties, and that's a recurring theme in American history. And so the Populist Party in the late 19th century and many others have seen their ideas stolen away but incorporated into public policy.
Well, do you see a trend also in third-party politics today where many of the third parties are also kind of edging toward a line that is a bit confusing? They seem to be behaving much like the big parties. They're not in the communities where they ought to be and where one would think they have a compatible and sympathetic audience waiting to hear from them, but they're not there. The attitude being, you know, we are here, you come to us. We don't have to come to you. You should be smart enough to discover who we are and to, you know, tie your wagon to our horse. So do you see that third parties in significant ways are parting from the standard norm of politicking?
Well, you know, I think we have had a departure from what you're talking about, retail politics, anyway. You know, we live in an era of mass media now, and there's just not much of that grassroots kind of thing going on, and there is a lot of manipulation of people through the internet and all of that, but I guess I would blame politics in general for that. There are third parties that are local, and some of the most successful current third parties are local. You know, if you want a state to look at that comes closest to being multi-party, it would be Vermont. the most rural state in the Northeast, and there is in Vermont a progressive party that began in Burlington, and it began with that kind of retail politics. Bernie Sanders was the mayor of Burlington, participated in forming the Progressive Party, although he's since gone to Washington as an independent rather than having the P word by his name specifically. But he left behind a legacy of a strong progressive party, and there are in the state legislature of Vermont quite a number of people in the legislature with the word progressive by their name, and in the city council of Burlington, and in other places in Vermont as well. But I think you're right, but I would say that that's also a problem that the Democrats and the Republicans have in their mode of operation. We've moved away from that that retail politics. By the way, Media are another area in which there is such discrimination. And it is a real shame because we have cable news and they have the need to fill 24/7 news cycles and all of that. And yet there is just notorious discrimination against third parties and even in the, maybe especially in the elite media. I came across a survey that was done, actually a content analytical study that was done in 2008 in terms of how much space the New York Times and the Washington Post gave to the two major candidates versus how much they gave to the four leading minor candidates. And the space was 100-1. And so it is really a problem of them what has is them what gets, the old song. Media, you know, feel like people are not interested in a party that doesn't have a chance of winning. And so, you know, you compound the difficulties that third parties have.
Our guest is J. David Gillespie. He's a professor of political science at the College of Charleston. He has written two books on the subject of third parties, so smashing the political duopoly. One is called Politics at the Periphery, Third Parties in Two-Party America. And the other one, which we're referencing today, is called Challengers to Duopoly: Why Third Parties Matter in American Two-Party Politics. We'll be taking your calls very shortly, as soon as you make them, at 888-874-4888. Again, our guest, Professor J. David Gillespie. What do you see on the horizon as a kind of note of encouragement about the direction that third parties could force people into reconsidering their own psychological ties to these parties, either Democrat or Republican? What is happening either by itself in society or being caused to happen by third parties and their influence to pry loose these folks who are just wedded to this notion that there can't be any other way except the Democrats and Republicans?
Right. Well, that is what we have learned in the past. There are some institutional possibilities that are quite bright, in my opinion. And I wanted to mention one with regard to presidential elections. If we could get beyond the electoral college system where take all, it would be such a wonderful thing if we could replace that with instant runoff voting. We use that in a lot of local jurisdictions now. No way we're going to get to it with the electoral college system, I suspect. But if we could, going back to 2000 when we had the problem with Mr. Nader and Mr. Bush and Mr. Gore in Florida, the instant runoff system would allow people to have more than one vote, and you could vote with your head and you could vote with your heart. And if you did that, then people could have voted for example, Mr. Gore and Mr. Nader, and not had to decide whether you're going to vote with your head or with your heart in a situation like that. That's not going to happen. But one thing that may very well happen institutionally, and I'm pretty psyched about this and pretty encouraged, is something called the National Popular Vote Compact. And it would not require a constitutional amendment to do away with the Electoral College. What it would say is every state is to retain its electoral votes, but what you have is an emerging agreement among states that we will cast our electoral votes for the national popular vote winner, and it would not go into effect until states with 270 electoral votes agreed to do it. In other words, it would be a commitment that we will always have the winner, the popular winner, to win the election, because however people vote in our state electorally, we're going to vote for the national winner. That takes a bit of explaining. For example, my own state of South Carolina always votes red, always votes Republican. And if South Carolina were to enter into that, it would be a commitment that, you know, if there are enough other states to make this work, South Carolina would vote for the national winner, whatever the national winner might be. And what that would do for third parties is to allow a person, for example, in Florida in 2000, to say, okay, I'm going to vote for Ralph Nader, even though I much prefer Al Gore over George Bush, because I know that however that comes out, I'm contributing to Ralph Nader's total, but if Al Gore wins a plurality of the votes, he's going to get the electoral votes. And so you don't have that sense of spoiling in that, throwing your vote away or something of this sort. And I'm proud to tell you, or happy to tell you, that we're about 60% of the way to that national popular vote mandate. The state of New York, in its Senate and House, passed that compact on March the 25th, and that puts us at 60% of the votes necessary to put that into effect. In other words, when it gets to 270, that compact would take effect, you know, and we'd always have a national winner in that, and people would not worry about spoiling you know, this election spoiling. I think right now, you know, people simply try to rationally calculate, am I throwing my vote away if I vote for a candidate who cannot win? And it's, I can't say that's an irrational thing that they're doing. You know, it's a pretty reasonable thing to think, I better vote for the lesser of two evils, even if that lesser is evil, in my opinion.
From Brooklyn, the People's Democratic Republic, Dave, you're on the air with Professor J. David Gillespie.
Hi, Professor Gillespie.
How are you?
Okay. I just wanted to add, I'm glad you brought up the media, because that's what I was thinking at the moment that you brought it up. But there's one other aspect that I'd like to bring up about the media, and it's that they make a lot of money on the political ads. And the only way that the two corporate parties can get that money is by corporate donations. And most of the smaller parties won't go there, you know, because they want to keep their independence. So, and so the media, I think, is complicit intentionally in steering people away from actually, like in the 1800s, which you mentioned, they used to print the full speeches of candidates.
Right.
And they don't do that anymore. In fact, all you get from the candidates is basically sound bites these days. And the reason
Absolutely. That,
I think, is because they want to steer people into getting their information from the political ads, which they make a ton of money on.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you on that at all. And as a matter of fact, what happened with the Citizens United case is the super PACs are so aligned with one candidate or another, and it's never a third-party candidate. You can bet your boots on that, because they're backing what they consider to be a winner. And, you know, there's just almost no accountability there at all, as long as they formally keep their distance from the campaign organization of a major party. They can pretty much spend as they want to. And obviously the media are complicit in that and are beneficiaries of that.
Thank you, Dave, for your question. 888-874-4888. We've talked a lot about the two-party political system as being less than accommodating of the unique interests that specific groups have. Now, if a third-party system were to emerge that all of these splinter groups, if you would, well, or these communities of interest would actually elect their own particular parties, does that in fact erode the whole idea, or does that not contribute to the balkanization again of a society?
There are democracies that handle multi-party systems very well indeed, and you have to organize your institutions along those lines. I've always been rather taken by the French system. They have a two-stage presidential system, for example. There are many parties. People go the first day and they vote their hearts, and then it comes down to two candidates. And what happens then is the left coalesces, the various parties coalesce around the person who's coming number one on the left-hand side, and then the right and center will coalesce around the leading candidate there, and so you go back and vote your head. Now, obviously, we're going to have one titular leader, for example, you know, and that sort of thing, and if we were to use proportional representation in Congress, for example, or in state legislatures, there's going to have to be some kind of coalition building between parties and that sort of thing. But people handle it that way. And I think, very frankly, the two-party system today creates a sense of zero-sum game. What the Republicans get, the Democrats lose, and vice versa. And there is more accommodation, or can be more accommodation, where you have a multi-party system in the legislature, for example, than would be the case with a two-party system. Connecticut, for example, elected a third-party governor, Lowell Weicker. And Lowell Weicker brought to Connecticut a number of years ago an income tax for the first time. Income tax is never desired particularly, but Connecticut needed that income tax. He was elected on a third-party ticket called the a Connecticut party in that state. And he managed to get the Democrats and the Republicans together. He didn't have a single member of his own party in the state legislature, but managed to bring the Democrats and the Republicans together around the need to finance government, you know, positive government in the state of Connecticut. So I think that a multi-party system, if you arrange the institutions, can be every bit as effective. My goodness, our present two-party system is totally paralyzed today because of the partisan gridlock in Washington. You know, I think they're both in many ways corporate-sponsored parties, but we're accomplishing absolutely nothing in the Congress of the United States these days. And so I guess my answer to anybody's question, can a multi-party system work? My answer to that would be, well, examine the current two-party system and tell me whether it's working or not.
I wanted to ask about the relationship between social conditions and economic conditions and the rise of third parties. Does it occur to you to be significant that with all the foment that is going on in our society today, that we're not seeing a major formation of opposition via third party challenges?
There's no doubt that historically some of the most powerful of third parties, even though they have generally been flashes in the pan and have not lasted, have come as a result of some kind of major economic stimulus or depression or war or something of that sort. We may not have that kind of stimulus at a sufficient level right now, but we certainly do have our share of problems. You know, one of the issues that I think it would be interesting to examine is where the oxygen ideologically resides now for a third party. We've always thought of third parties as naturally residing to the left or the right of the two major parties. And, you know, I've always had a particular affection for progressive third parties. But if indeed, and in your preface you talked about the question of whether the Democrats and the Republicans have moved apart or have stayed together, there are people who argue that the place where a third party is most likely to arise is at the center. That was certainly Ross Perot's insight, that we have certain things like globalization that neither party is addressing, but basically the two parties have moved far apart from each other, and there is space at the center. So Ross Perot is remembered as a centrist with an attitude. And, you know, the attitude was, you know, he was to rev up the people, you know, to, you know, challenge the insiders that have messed things up in Washington and in state legislatures and that sort of thing. So you might want to look. There was in 2012 a centrist movement called Americans Elect. They were well-funded, and they were going to bring another insight, which was a democratic nominating process in which any registered voter in the United States could participate in an online convention. And they were sort of taken over, I think, by people who did not have the same vision that Americans Elect did. A lot of the people that, you know, joined in Americans Elect were Ron Paul supporters and people who were looking for some other passage for maybe that particular point of view. I think the original thinkers along this line wanted it to be a centrist party reflecting the need for a party of the center at a time where the Democrats and the Republicans have moved further apart ideologically. To me, that's interesting. I don't know whether that's very appealing. You know, if it's a party of the center, does that really provide much of a policy alternative to what we have already, you know? So, but that at any rate is what a lot of people are thinking, that if you see a third party arising, it's likely to be at the center these days.
From New Jersey, Michael, you're on the air.
Utrice, and greetings, Professor.
Greetings.
Thank you.
I think that, you know, my understanding, which isn't a lot, is that a lot of the blocks to the efficacy of a third party come from our Constitution itself, all these, because that's where all this comes from. And it seems to me that, you know, we have to get into, get a wrench into the Constitution itself if we want to loosen up things for more democracy to come into the system via third party or representational voting or
right.
These other issues. And I think that if we can't get a wrench into the Constitution itself, we have to find ways around it. For example, in California, they use the referendum to create
right.
much of their public policy. They You know,
right.
They're not put off by politicians and government and everything. They go out and create their own public policy through referendum. And it's good for California, or maybe not, but they do that. Now, is it possible to do the same thing on a national level, to have some kind of a national? That's what I thought in your last reference to the Americans Elect. Is there a way to get around it through a national referendum, for example?
Well, we do not have institutionalized referenda at the national level. California is not alone in using referendum, and that has been an important part of policymaking in the states that do have it. I think you're exactly right about the Constitution. And by the way, we tend to venerate that document, and maybe rightly so. I have a very strong affection for the Bill of Rights, for example, and especially the First and Fourth Amendments to the Constitution. But boy, that separation of powers stuff in the original document is really causing us a lot of grief now, you know, and a lot of that institutional structure, by the way, it was not instituted by people who worshipped a two-party system. All of our founding framers expressed a disdain for parties in general, but what it has produced is a situation in which you have, as I think Madison said, interest counteracting interest, that kind of thing, and the logic of it is a kind of two-party logic to it. Whether that can be dismantled or not, it certainly is a major undertaking, because generally speaking, the way in which we amend the Constitution is two-thirds vote of Congress proposing and three-quarters of the states ratifying, and getting three-quarters of the states to ratify anything is very difficult. But there is another approach, and that is the calling of a national convention. And, boy, that scares everybody to death, I think, on the left and the right, because the last time we had a national convention is when they wrote that Constitution in 1787, and they far exceeded their mandate. I mean, what they did was they took us in a direction that was much better than where we had been. But you never know what's going to come out of a situation like that. But I really appreciate your comment about that, because I had my students this last fall to read an article that basically said exactly what you're saying, that what we're going to have to do is to have a major, major revamping of the Constitution of the United States.
Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome.
From Los Angeles, DX, you're on the air.
Hello, you trees. How are you?
Hello. Fine, thank you.
Good. And greetings to you, Professor Gillespie.
Greetings to you as well.
I just had a couple of thoughts I was thinking while you were talking. I think there's a lot of barriers to third parties. But first of all, a lot of things about the federal political process really make me shake my head. I mean, like, one of them is the Senate, like, which was obviously put there to quell any kind of progressive policies from going through. I mean, I got nothing against Idaho or North Dakota, but the idea that they get just as many votes in the Senate as a state like New York or California, I think it's totally ridiculous.
I totally agree with that.
Right. And so I believe that federal politics, and maybe some won't like that I'm saying this, but I think it's useless for the average person to even participate at this point until we get some of these things fixed, or however you want to say that. So I am in favor of because I don't agree that the Democrats are the so-called left and then the Republicans are the right. I think the Democrats have moved ever since Clinton started this, the corporate Democrat model, and I think they've moved past the center and they're center right, and the Republicans have moved sometimes way off the table to the right, and so I'm in favor of local elections, city, towns, and there are successful models that have been carried out. For instance, in California here, Gail McLaughlin, the mayor of Richmond, California, she ran as a progressive, I believe. Then we have Kashama Sawant in Seattle, who ran as city council as a socialist.
Socialist, right.
And we had
Gail McLaughlin is a Green, I understand, unless she's changed that affiliation. I'm pretty sure she was elected as a Green in Richland there. So.
Right. I believe you're right. And then we had the mayor of Jackson, who just passed away, Chokwe Lumumba, who I believe ran as either socialist or, well, some are progressive or, I don't know. But my point is, first of all, in California, they have something where you could call registering as a decline to state. It's the same thing as independent, but I guess they came up with that because there was too much confusion between the independent party and independents. Okay, so I am, in fact, registered as a decline to state voter. So what I wanted to know about these local elections, some of the examples I've pointed out, and then there are a few more. What is your analysis of how these were successful, and what are the differences between federally and city or citywide or locally that can make these successes happen?
Well, I think the simple answer to that is the country is so diverse that it's very difficult to put together a third party that appeals to enough people to get it off the ground nationally. Whereas locally, I was mentioning earlier, you may have heard me talk about Vermont and the Progressive Party in Vermont. That's a fairly homogenous state, you know, and there are ways in which you can organize at the retail level on that, or in Richland, California. A lot of the places where Greens are in power, or where they have significant presence, are, to be very frank about it, in university towns like Madison, Wisconsin, for example, or Chapel Hill, North Carolina, or Berkeley, or some places like that. So I think a lot just depends upon the nature of the local political environment, you know, as to whether a third party, especially a third party of the left, is going to work, you know, but it's more problematic at the national level. Going back to what you were talking about, the Senate, under our Constitution, you know, I mentioned that you have to have a three-quarters vote of the states usually for an amendment, but they wrote into the document of the Constitution in 1787 that no state may be denied its equal suffrage in the Senate without its own approval. So if you use the standard amending process for the Senate, you'd have to have all 50 states to agree to use population as the basis. So there are just incredible problems, you know, with reforming the Constitution.
Absolutely, and we know that's not going to happen, because who wants to vote themselves out of a job?
Yeah, well, I live in South Carolina, a smaller state, and I can tell you it's never going to approve giving up its equal suffrage in the Senate, for example.
Exactly.
You know?
Well, thank you, Dr. Gillespie. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks. So let's see if we can get some ideas of what's next in this discussion on third parties, Professor Gillespie.
Right. Well, you know, I think you've hit an interesting tone. I think there needs to be more emphasis upon retail politics, probably local politics, as several of your callers talked about, perhaps building from the ground up. And insofar as you take on the media, take it on using new methods that can in some ways circumvent the discrimination of traditional media. I mean, there's Twitter, there's Facebook, there are websites, there are blogs, there are all kinds of things that, and third parties are beginning to learn about those things and how to use those things, you know. So that's the glimmer of hope that I think you see there. And also build on the fact that the American people are not lying when they say they're tired of this two-party system. This is not the equivalent of Americanism, that the two-party system is not working. They say that they're not being well represented by the Democrats and the Republicans, and there just needs to be a barrage of information put out there by third parties. And there's already developing at the periphery a large group, independent political report, for example, every night, Richard Winger's ballot access news. There's already beginning to be a kind of community of third-party people who don't agree with each other, even in terms of party label, much less ideology necessarily, but agree that, boy, we've got to get out of this somehow. We've got to democratize our society.
Well, it's been quite an instruction listening to you today and participating with the listeners' calls as well. So much information was generated on this program today with respect to third-party possibilities. And it is something that I encourage people all the time to reconsider your political actions and your political mindset. Try to get out of this two-party system thing and forge a different path. So, having said that, it is therefore my obligation to put before the listeners some examples and some of the thinking that should go into making up one's mind about taking another path. And for that, I thank you so much, Professor Gillespie, for being with us today. It's been
fantastic.
Well,
thank you so much for having me. I appreciate that very much.
Thank you. J. David Gillespie is the author of Challengers to Duopoly, Why Third Parties Matter in American Two-Party Politics, and Politics at the Periphery, Third Parties in a Two-Party America, both books by University of South Carolina Press. We've come to the end of our program today. I hope it was useful and valuable and informative for you. And, of course, let's meet here again tomorrow. But I need you to do some work. I need you to call all your peeps, all the folks you know, and tell them about PRN.FM and your favorite program right here. Coming up next, by the way, is Alternative Visions with Jack Rasmus. Stay tuned, and we'll see each other tomorrow. Thanks.